This event was recorded live as a part of the Cleveland Council on World Affairs Foreign Policy Forum. Jeremy R. Haft joined us to discuss the myth of China's might and what it means for America. Please visit ccwa.org to learn more about our upcoming speaker series programs.
Am I on? Okay. Thank you, Heather, Maura, who could not be here, Maura, and the council, and thank you all for coming. It is a timely topic, China. I mean, President Trump is in China today, meeting with President Xi, and my agents on the ground informed me that a giant mooncake was brought out to President Xi, and he said, "My mooncake is bigger than your chocolate chip cake." So that's the latest in diplomacy. I'm sure we'll read about it in Twitter shortly. So tonight, actually, I'd like to take a step back and talk about, well, the myth of China's might. So when we talk about China and when we read about China and we think about Donald Trump being in China today, we think about it as being the China century. And really, in the years leading up to this election, you know, we saw that widespread belief. Pew does an attitude survey every few years globally. And a recent attitude survey before the last presidential election showed that a majority of Americans were asked, what is the world's sole leading economic superpower? And a majority of Americans said China. A majority of British said China. And a majority of people from 26 countries around the world said China is the world's leading economic superpower. Now, guess what country was the one that voted overwhelmingly that China was not the number one economic superpower? That was China. But you can look at a theme like Make America Great Again, and you don't have to be a supporter of the campaign to feel what the campaign is trying to get at. I mean, if we're all told that China is the world's leading economy and believe it, and by the way, this is how we hear about China in the media. So I ask you to read any article about China in the last 30 years, and we heard China, comma, the world's second largest economy. We've heard that for many, many years. Now recently, 2015, you heard major economists like Joseph Stiglitz and the World Bank announce that China is the leading economy. So Make America Great Again kind of takes on an existential feel to it, right? I mean, maybe we are going to be the first generation that's not going to do better than our parents did. Maybe we are on a race to the bottom in quality of life and jobs with China. And you know, what we saw this election and what we heard a lot in the rhetoric was, you know, we heard it before. So if we go back to Obama, Romney, who can tell me, now Romney's theme was not Make America Great Again, but it was something close. It was a cousin to it. Does anyone remember Romney's slogan for extra cider? Believe in America. Believe in America. So Romney was trying to get at some of these themes, and if you remember the ads in that election, there were about $1 billion spent, mostly on negative ads. Tens of millions of those ads were directly about China stealing U.S. jobs. Whether that was from the Obama side, you know, Obama said Romney was one of the architects of outsourcing, and then Romney accused Obama of sending jobs overseas. Guess what? Over 4,700 of those ads were aired in Cleveland alone, okay? So your metro media market was assaulted by negative ads by both sides with the backdrop of China stealing our jobs through massive trade imbalances. So tonight, I want to unpack that a little bit before talking about kind of how we really need to be looking at China. The way we have looked at China traditionally is through two lenses, right? One is China's the world's leading economy. What do we base that on? That's GDP. okay, gross domestic product, which we were talking at John Carroll this morning. And if you ask even an econ student, what does that mean? It's the amount of product that we make, right? Now, the fact of the matter is GDP has become synonymous with our economy. So recently, the GDP figures were announced. And what did we say? Oh, the economy's up 4.1%. When we say the economy, we're talking about GDP. What is GDP? It was a number developed in FDR's administration to measure the output of the American economy as we were crawling out of the Great Depression. And the way that the World Bank and the IMF and economists build a GDP model is through spending. They add up spending. So they add up the spending of households and businesses in terms of investment and government, okay? And that's GDP. Well, that's interesting, but I mean, if I were trying to compare, I'm keeping up with the Joneses. Let's say we're comparing households and wealth, which is sort of like comparing countries, right? Am I gonna say, okay, my kids, it was a big year, you know, we had braces, and there was the trip to Paris, and summer camp, but I spent $500,000 last year, and you spent $750,000, therefore you're the leading economy, you're the bigger, wealthier household. No. You don't need to be an economist to know that we compare wealth through looking at what's called the balance sheet. Businesses will call it the balance sheet. So what you're doing is you're looking at assets and liabilities. What do you own versus what do you owe? So if you look at that number, it's called national wealth. That's the economic number. And if you compare the national wealth of the United States and China, and you completely include all of our debt, the $20 trillion in debt that we owe, some of that to China, by the way. So if you include that in there, right, and you include households and how much households own minus what they owe and businesses, and you compare that to China, the United States is $60 trillion richer on the balance sheet than China. And these are not numbers that I sort of came up with on the back of an envelope. This is the Federal Reserve, which publishes a yearly report on American wealth, and they measure household wealth, and Credit Suisse and the World Bank measure Chinese wealth. So then you think, well, China's catching up quickly, but actually no, the gap is growing, but it's America that's getting richer and China's kind of stagnating, which we'll talk about tonight. But the narrative that China has overtaken the United States in the global economy and is essentially writing the rules for trade and economics of the next century is based on GDP, which is a number that bears very little resemblance to reality. Okay? China's true economic ranking, if you look at their national wealth, is somewhere around France. All right? So if GDP is an unreliable number, surely China must be stealing our jobs en masse because of these trade imbalances that we keep hearing about. So yeah, we could be $60 trillion wealthier, my friend, but what does that mean to me when I'm a manufacturing center and I'm losing jobs to China every year? And the interesting thing that happened in the last election, which did not happen in the Romney-Obama election, despite Believe in America, was that a giant rift was exposed in both the left and right political sides of this country, such that Trump supporters and Bernie supporters aligned on certain trade issues. And so Steve Bannon said in a recent interview, we knew we had to quote Steve Bannon tonight, right? So no, Steve Bannon said in a recent interview on Charlie Rose that the next election will be economic populism. Now, whether that populism comes from the left or the right will be determined. I think that's an interesting point. The energy in the electorate that drove 25 million Democrats and Republicans to vote away from the establishment candidates of Jeb, exclamation point, and Hillary towards, Trump and Bernie, a lot of that was driven by trade grievance. Remember the Democratic convention? Down with the TPP, the signs. So where Trump and the economic populace on the left align is in pursuing policies that protect American workers. And what's wrong with that? right? I mean, if China's taking our jobs by keeping their currency artificially low and cheating, as we've heard for so many years by so many different leaders, what's wrong with protecting American workers? What's wrong with putting up tariffs on steel and tariffs on solar panels? Heck, let's put tariffs up across the board on China. Why not? And whether you support Bernie or the president, that's a position that feels good. And guess what? The numbers back it up. So when our trade representative, Lighthizer, is in China, or Wilbur Ross, and we're talking about the trade imbalance, and we're going and renegotiating trade deals and walking out of some trade deals and trying to get NAFTA fixed, the trade imbalance is the focus right now. We want to eliminate this trade imbalance. Well, like GDP, the trade imbalance is a number that was conceived long before globalization and bears very little resemblance on how economics functions today. Who remembers David Ricardo from school and trading wine for cloth? All right, that's classic trade theory. That's 1817. So by that classic theory, one country makes wine really well, one country makes cloth really well, and they create wealth mutually by trading with one another. Well, these days, trade doesn't work that way. If you look around the room, or think about what you consumed today, most of it was made by many countries. Products are made in the world these days, not by one country or two, but often many. And yet, we still measure trade as if we were trading wine for cloth. So to give you an example, here's an obscure import from China, right? We've never seen this before. We measure this as 100% Chinese value because our wine for cloth trade statistics assign 100% of the value of the products we import to the last country that shipped them to us. So 100%, because this comes from China, we assign 100% in our trade balances with China. Guess how much value, really Chinese value, goes into one of these things in terms of content and labor? Is it 10%? Is it 15%? Is it 5%? It's closer to 5. It's probably 4. Okay? A lot of the components are made in the United States. A lot of the components are made in South Korea. A lot of the components are made in Germany and Japan. But our gross trade balances do not capture those values. Now, when you start to look at those values at trade, a different picture emerges. And suddenly, policies that are originally intended to protect American workers, you realize, wind up doing the opposite. So I'll give you an example. President Obama's solar panel tariffs. So Solar World, an American-based company, which is owned by a German company, went to the Commerce Department and said, we are being assaulted by cheap Chinese solar panels. You must do something about this. And so the Commerce Department, which has jurisdiction, erects a 249% trade tariff on incoming solar panels. Interestingly enough, this was a net job loss for the solar panel industry. Why? Now, if you look at solar panels from the gross trade balance perspective, China looks like they're cleaning their clocks on solar. Everyone says, oh, China's winning the war on solar. But if you look at it in value-added trade, you see that actually America is a net exporter to China in solar. We sell them more than we buy from them. And what do we sell them? The stuff that goes into the panels. So for example, PV polysilicon, which is the raw material that goes into panels, America makes that. We mine that in Washington State. We're a major world supplier of that. We sell that to China. We also sell China the capital equipment that makes the panels. So walk this through with me, okay? You raise tariffs on the panels, so you make it more expensive to bring Chinese panels, so the imports slow, right? Therefore, you're depressing demand for the upstream raw materials and capital equipment. Therefore, you're losing jobs upstream. And indeed, the major miner and supplier of PV polysilicon in Washington State had to shutter its doors from one of its factories after these tariffs were erected. The problem with tariffs in a global supply chain is that most products that we make, we actually have a big contribution to. So if you look at imports from China, for example, usually at least 55 cents of every dollar we spend on Chinese goods go to the services associated with marketing it and getting them to market. In addition to that, another 10 to 20 cents goes to inputs and components. So for example, the return air grills that I hope you're feeling, you know, the airflow from, probably come from recycled steel that is from America, because China still lacks a recycling market. They import a lot of recycled scrap from the United States. That would factor into the content of an everyday item. There are items all around us that American content are hiding inside of. You know, we tend to think, well, everything is made in China. The problem is that on these made in China labels, they don't tell about the American content, and that's good and that's bad. It's bad if you're buying dog food for your pet and it says made in America, and yet ingredients are coming from China, and there's no obligation to disclose that, and so pets are dying from melamine in the pet food. So labeling laws go both ways in terms of, you know, obscuring the made in China, obscuring the made in America. But at the end of the day, the trade imbalance is not a driver of job loss. So ultimately, if you look at imports versus jobs in this country over the past 30 years, our imports have increased. And for the most part, our employment, you know, we've been employed, right? And the unemployment rate has been improving, with the exception of some recessionary activity. But at the end of the day, imports, such as of the solar panels, when they come in, they're driving jobs upstream. And you often find that with many products. Why is that important to think about China? For the next century, I would argue that we need to think about China from a position of being $60 trillion wealthier, right? And with tremendous surpluses in many industries. So our agriculture sector is actually booming and selling a lot to China. We have trade surpluses with China on ag, also on services. Why is that? So I would argue that the better way to look at China and its supposed might is not so much through the lens of GDP or trade balances, but through scarcity and through looking at how China needs to feed itself in the next century. So this is why our ag sector, part of why it's booming. China has 20% of the world's population, 8% of the world's arable land. So you could fit China's arable land on the state of Texas, essentially. And that land is shrinking every year by about 1,200 miles as the Gobi Desert expands. China today is in a severe water crisis in many cities. Actually, in 18 of the 20 largest cities, 3/5 of the groundwater is unfit to drink at this time. In the countryside, a lot of the water is unfit even for agriculture. The air, as we know, is a major problem with long-term cancer villages, which are, you know, popping up around the country. So I would argue that what we typically hear of as the drivers of our economic clash and the Thucydides trap, you know, with this rising power, are not so much that China's rising, but that all indicators point to a stagnating China for perhaps the next 20 years. Stagnating because of demography. Look at Japan. China has become old before it has become rich. China has more elderly than it has workers. Demographically now, the country has begun to move on an inexorable path towards shrinking in its labor force. That's a headwind on the Chinese economy. A need to balance an economy that has been driven mostly by investment, meaning government printing money and pumping it into the economy to keep state-owned enterprises propping up industries. You think we have an issue with potential broad money supply? China's broad money supply, the amount of money floating around, is 70% larger than ours. It's a much smaller economy. They think, no one knows how large it is. It's probably much larger. We have a $20 trillion debt. China's a $25 trillion debt on the books. Right? A lot of that debt was pushed to the local level. And at the local level, you're not allowed to keep it on the books. So a lot of special vehicles were created on the side. Remember Enron and Chewbacca and all those like crazy Star Wars funds? That's what's going on at the local level in China, where the debt is being sort of pushed around. So President Xi, although he just wrote himself into the Constitution and is claiming to challenge the world with this Made in China 2025 initiative, is facing kind of a, not so much a Lyndon Johnson's guns and butter trade-off, but you're getting a trade-off between the retrenchment of the state, where you have the state owning more and more industries again like it used to, plus more money in the budget spent on internal security than the military every year, trying to keep control over population. You also have a projection of power in the South China Sea, so there's not unlimited money, right? And what we've seen over the past year or two is actually a flight of capital out of China, $1 trillion left. And what did China do? Doomsday. This has been another myth of, well, China owns so much US debt in terms of treasury bills. They're our banker. What happens if they sold all their debt on a given Tuesday? We heard that all through the Obama-Romney election from both sides. We also heard it from left and right, from everyone from Sarah Palin to Jon Stewart on The Daily Show, to Wolf Blitzer in between. Guess what? It happened. Last year, China sold $800 billion out of the blue. Did you notice anything, right? What did the doomsday people say? Oh, interest rates will go through the roof and the dollar is gonna collapse, and none of that happened. Why? Because our bond market is a $30 trillion bond market, okay, right? Let's take a deep breath. China owns a tiny sliver of that market. A tiny sliver. And guess what? With all that money, which is shrinking quickly of China's foreign reserves as it tries to keep it, the renminbi, from collapsing and keeping it high, and as it's selling more and more T-bills, there's really very, very little in terms of options for the Chinese government to take that money and put it anywhere else. There's no bond market that's a $30 trillion liquid bond market like the United States. In Europe, they have country bond markets. Germany has one, but there's no EU continental bond market. So China has nowhere else to really park that money except for investing it in US companies and US assets. And we're starting to see China make big plays in areas where China is scarce, such as pork. What, you know, what company did China acquire a couple years ago? Smithfield out of Virginia, the world's largest pork producer, okay? Supposedly a private company and a listed company, and yet the loan to buy the company, $4 billion of it was financed overnight from the government. I love that, right? So essentially we have a state-owned affiliated actor having the largest pork company in the United States, and more of those investments will continue, I predict, along areas where China has scarcity. This is good news for America and bad news for America. So the good news is that the scarcity of China, if China indeed is stagnating and still needs to feed its population and has created wealth and has created consumers, those consumers would rather spend their money on products that they deem safe. So we tend to think of China as this juggernaut that can make anything we can but cheaper. If you're a mom in Beijing, you see every day that there's another safety scandal in the paper. I mean, there have literally been thousands and thousands across the country over the past decade, perhaps 10,000, perhaps more. No one knows. And they touch every corner of China's economy, food and drugs especially, with broad magnification. I mean, 300,000 Chinese babies having kidney failure because of an industrial chemical and baby formula is one, you know, one example of thousands of issues. Gruesome details, like the ones you find in the jungle of Upton Sinclair in the 1920s. So China struggles to get a handle on this problem because China has not yet gone through the Industrial Revolution that the United States has, right? So where we might have a couple players in a supply chain, China might have 17. And especially if it's an agricultural product, there are 140 million Chinese farmers living on tiny hectares of starved land. Those are the inputs into our food and drug supply. So when heparin comes over in the form of blood thinner and kills 140 Americans from China, those are coming from an input that's agricultural. I hope you all have eaten dinner a while ago, because it comes from the intestines, the mucus of intestines of pigs, okay, is what heparin crude is. That was the raw material input from China that had contaminated batches that made it into our supply chain. Problem is, we inspect maybe 2% of what comes in. And so the more China sells us, although it does create jobs and support jobs, it also exposes us to danger. And so I would argue that the existential threat is not so much the boogeyman of China is going to run right over the United States, which is $60 trillion richer. Now, you may argue about how that wealth is distributed, but it's still wealth on the books, on the balance sheet. So the threat is less about existential threat, China outsourcing the next century, and more from exposure in our food and drug supply. If you look at the medicines we take every day, I talked about products that come from around the world. Advil, for example, you know, aspirin, all these medicines we take. 80% of the active pharmaceutical ingredients that go into the medicines that we take over the counter and through prescriptions are coming either from China and India. And India makes China look pretty safe, okay? India is actually sourcing a lot of its input from China too. And these inputs are largely unregulated. I mean, the FDA has this screening sort of algorithm that they use, right? It's called PREDICT, the PREDICT algorithm, which doesn't make me feel that safe, frankly. They don't do what Japan does. Japan actually has huge clearinghouses. They've been buying food and drugs from China for years, okay? They understand the risk that China endows and the stuff that it makes. They have huge warehouses in the ports where they screen food as it comes into the country and drugs. They inspect as much as 10% of stuff coming in, maybe more. We're maybe doing 2%. So I would argue that in a time of, you know, when we have scarcity in terms of our budgets, right, and I don't see budgets increasing for any of these departments like the FDA and the USDA, et cetera, I would urge us to focus our resources where they're desperately needed. Rather than attacking China as a currency manipulator, which we hear again and again and again, and which doesn't square with math, because if you look at the last 30 years and you look at the value of China's currency, you know, when they say that China's currency is really, really cheap, we should be bleeding jobs. And guess what? We're adding jobs. And we keep adding jobs. If you look at the last 30 years, we're basically adding jobs except for recessions. There's no correlation between the value of the yuan and the American employment rate, because the interconnectedness of the economies, while significant, maybe there's $1 trillion worth of trade that goes on between them. But in terms of assets, north of a $90 trillion economy. I mean, this is some exposure, but this is not our whole breadbasket is China. And so thinking about the next century, I would say we need to take a breath on the existentialism of China about to step into a vacuum that we have walked out of, and instead protect ourselves from the negative externalities of trade that are real, right? So trade, on pure trade, is not purely good, okay? Tariffs do kill jobs, but trade also exposes us to risk from global supply chains that inflict us in food and drugs, but also in DOD. The military supply chain has had hearings about counterfeit parts coming from China and disrupting mission critical systems. So we need to be thinking more broadly about how do we protect ourselves from those risks of trade, and less about trying to fight back on perceived threats like currency and T-bills, which are not symbols of China's might. In fact, we have misread. And I would argue, as you're looking at the GDP figures next quarter, remind yourself that GDP is not synonymous with the economy at large, that it is only spending. And that while any net job growth is good, right? So when we say we added 126,000 jobs to the economy, we need to remember that our economy is much deeper. And in fact, we churn through 4 to 6 million jobs a month. That means we create 4 to 6 million jobs a month and we destroy 4 to 6 million jobs. And on top of those millions of jobs, the net is what we say we lost or gained. So those millions of jobs every month are created and lost not because they're going to China, right? It's because of business activity. Jobs travel in and out of the United States. Some states have unions, some states don't have unions. You know, that impacts, you know, where jobs go. A lot of jobs, companies go out of business. But we are still a deep, churning, thriving economy. And adding net jobs on top of that is great. But we need to remember that those numbers can also be demagogued and politicized and remember that we're creating and destroying millions of jobs each month, and it's much more than just the 100,000 that we typically hear about. So I'm gonna leave it on jobs and say that Ohio year after year is in one of the top 10 United States exporting states to China and is integrally linked in the NAFTA platform. You know, such that cars that come in from Canada actually travel across the border 7 times. And over 70% of that content has to come from the United States. And where do you think a lot of it comes from? This state. So as policies get enacted that feel good, economic populism might feel good from the left or the right, the tariff protectionist policies, I caution us to remember that they often cost more jobs than they save. And I will leave it there and open it up to questions. Thank you.
Can you comment on the Belt and Road Initiative?
The One Belt, One Road Initiative. The One Belt, One Road Initiative is a signature infrastructure push by President Xi and his administration to project, I would say, soft power and economic power through Central Asia and down into the subcontinent. This is often seen as a counter to United States power in the region as well. You know, so policymakers look at this as kind of a direct threat on the projection of our power in the region. And I would caution us to remember one factor. And this is a factor that has not escaped many in China who have written about this and who've published in the New York Times some op-eds about state-owned enterprises in the construction realm and infrastructure realm. But I'll keep this brief, but I would point our attention to the San Francisco Bay Bridge. So the San Francisco Bay Bridge is an example of Chinese infrastructure. California turned down Obama's stimulus package so that they did not have to abide by the Buy America provisions that were in that package so that they could go to China to have the major renovation of a span of the San Francisco Bay Bridge made in China. Now, these deck plates that were the size of football fields were made in mile-long fabrication facilities. And you know, the entire California delegation and economic team and Caltrans went over there and looked at it and approved it, and there were American inspectors all over that thing. And you'd think, okay, steel and welding, how complicated could it be? The deck plates are coming off and the welds are coming to America cracked. And the American inspectors are sending up flags saying, there's random quality control here, okay? So no rhyme or reason, warning. We need to stop. And California Transportation Authority fired the inspectors and loosened the tolerances on the welds. And this is all documented in the San Francisco Gate and other newspapers. But this is the reason why major engineering and contracting companies like Halliburton choose not to source Chinese steel, for example, as an input into infrastructure projects around the world. Because state-owned enterprises, you know, by their very nature, lack accountability in their corporate governance and tend to create product that is risky. Not always, but they tend to. I mean, look at the bullet train accidents that have happened in China. They're because of systemic risk that hides in the shadows of a state-run corporation. So I'll leave it there, and let's open it up for more questions.
Thank you for your perspective on the irrational exuberance of China's economy. But I think it masks how we think about India's economy, which is growing faster than China's. Mm. And India has 50% more millennials, and that's where the growth is. Can you comment a little bit about how that kind of hides India's growth?
I'd be happy to talk a bit about India. And India will be another driver of scarcity economics in the coming century, as that population needs to be fed and powered and housed and clothed, as China will be. And when we say that India is growing faster than China, what we mean is that their GDP is growing faster. And if we just need to compare, I don't want to say apples to apples, but kumquat to curry masala, because both accounting systems are rigged. All right. So in China, the Statistical Bureau has essentially been made local. So every province has its own bureau. So imagine every state in the United States having its own Statistical Bureau that counts up its output. And oh, by the way, all the party folks who work for this bureau, we get promoted based on how much growth our province posts. So you get a situation like the producers where, you can't sell more than 100% of anything, Leo. Well, in China, when you add up the GDP of the provinces year after year, they add up to more than the national GDP. It's an impossible. And if you add up the growth of the provinces, they're growing faster than the overall growth of the country. So, Chinese officials don't believe their own numbers and have said so several times. We kind of wink at these now. They're man-made. They're for reference purposes only. But our economists and the World Bank and the IMF take them as gospel. So too with India. Their GDP accounting system is suspect. I mean, yes, India is growing quickly. I do not see either country, at least existentially, overtaking us. If anything, they present us with a threat to resources. How are you going to feed and power these folks in the next century and in a way that's sustainable? India is growing, but let's not think about it in terms of their GDP is growing. Think about it as their demand is growing. Now, this is great from a U.S. jobs business perspective to those who can harness this and create businesses. But part of the problem is some of these countries, like China, have been pretty protectionist. So they've let us in some areas, they haven't in others. So I'm arguing that the path they're on is not so sustainable. And it remains to be seen if President Xi can make the hard choices for the real reforms that will get to these issues. The jury's still out. I mean, I tend to be skeptical about that.
How does China buying Smithfield affect Smithfield?
How does buying Smithfield affect Smithfield? So that's a really good question. And I'm going to give you the 10-second primer of corporation law, okay? Now, we as Americans, right, we take for granted the fact that we are the beneficiaries of 400 years of corporation law. And that is baked into our corporate governance, and it's baked into the acculturation of quality in our companies. Most of our companies, not all, obviously, but most, understand how to make quality products. That's something that has taken hundreds of years in our culture. And when we compare that to China, we have maybe a 30-year experiments with kind of a quasi-market-driven capitalism. But the rule of law, like the uniform enforcement of the rule of law through an independent judiciary, has not taken root. And for those who argue that China's autocratic marriage of totalitarian authoritarianism with a market economy is lethal and is a combination that can't be beat, I would argue that that is the one thing that is holding China back. So to the extent that China keeps a lid on the movement of its people and capital and goods, it prevents itself from bringing true rule of law to its companies and contract enforcement. How can you do business if you don't have uniform contract enforcement and fraud that's uniformly enforced? We are potentially a century away on this in China. I kid you not. And that is not all we're a century away on. And this brings us back to Smithfield, agriculture. The Chinese Academy of Sciences, right, wrote that China is 100 years behind the United States in ag. Part of that is technology, because China's still oxen and hand, but part of it is John Locke, right? There's no private ownership of land in China, none of it. You're leasing it in some long-term arrangement with the state, okay? And so the farming system, as I've mentioned earlier in this talk, is 140 million small farmers who maybe have one starving cow and some vegetables that they're putting 17 different pesticides and herbicides on before they sell it into the market. I'm serious. A lot of this gets onto our plate. Two-thirds of the apple juice concentrate that goes into our apple juice comes from China. In China, you see arsenic scandals with apples all the time. It's scary. So the reason why China needs to buy Smithfield is because its own slaughterhouses have been exposed as filthy and corrupt, have lost huge stock market value, and so China gains more of an understanding of quality control from Smithfield, which is the world's finest management. The assets in a business like Smithfield are not so much in the packing, the slaughterhouse, and the packing, but also the assets are in the animals themselves. So they're also buying thousands and thousands and thousands of hogs in the United States. Now, this is but a blip in our market, and by the way, we have thousands and thousands more. And guess what, China needs them. So when we talked about cattle hides and maple syrup and wacky stuff selling to China, the main thing I sell to China is pork, even with Smithfield in the market. You've got all these interior cities that are a million people or above. You know, we have maybe 9 cities that are a million people or above. China's like 22 or more, you know. So all those folks want to eat pork. Now beef is opening. So we need to figure out in the next century, right, how to feed China and the world, but also feed ourselves and not waste the amount that we do. That will be the sustainable, and figure out a better way to get it back and forth, because as we're shipping this food around the world, our food is going to China too. When you trust the Gordon's fishermen, you know, you open a box of fish sticks, that fish might have been caught off the coast of Alaska, but it was sent to China to be deboned and breaded and boxed and bagged and sent back over again. That's like 80% of our seafood. And those ships, I mean, basically, as consumers and as businesses, we're subsidizing all those carbon miles, right? Because those ships are burning bunker fuel as they travel across the oceans, thousands of miles, just to save us a few pennies on fish sticks. And at the end of the day, we as consumers and businesses, we don't pay for those carbon miles. Ultimately, we pay for them in our public health. But if you want to fix trade, I would say, let's not focus on tariffs, you know, so much as the carbon footprint as another negative externality of trade, in addition to risk. So we talked about health and safety as one negative externality, carbon miles is another. Let's regulate that, and you'll see more trade and business coming back to the United States because the cost model is cheaper, without killing jobs indiscriminately, which tariffs do.
You spoke about gross national product being measured by consumption, not by production. But a lot of that consumption is of imported goods, so how can that be a reliable measure of gross national product?
That's a great question. And the import component is factored into gross domestic product. So gross domestic product essentially is adding up what's called expenditures. And everyone's awake talking about GDP at this hour, which I commend everyone for. Thank you. So you didn't think you'd be going deep on GDP, right? But so expenditures from the main sectors of the economy, households, businesses, and government, plus the value of exports, minus the value of imports. So that's how we factor trade into our GDP. But the interesting thing is that if we look at our imports as more than just wine for cloth, and we consider that some imports actually create jobs in our country and support jobs, you start to look at GDP a little bit differently. And I would argue this is another reason why GDP is an unreliable metric. Because at the end of the day, imports are not a direct hit on jobs. And as I've mentioned, if you look at the last 30 years, you see imports have been rising and rising and rising. And our jobs, essentially, have been continually adding jobs to our economy. Such that the Federal Reserve, recently made a pronouncement that said that the relationship between GDP and job growth, which is called Okun's Law, so this was developed in JFK, in the year of JFK. Basically, have you heard this? Like every point of GDP growth will create X amount of jobs, and therefore we need to grow the economy. So recently, when the GDP grew to 4.1%, it was an argument for the administration to say, okay, well, we're adding X amount of jobs. Not so fast as the Fed. The Fed said that the relationship between jobs and GDP growth is dynamic. Dynamic. Why? Because of the last 8 years of growth under Obama were very interesting. We saw what's been generously called anemic growth in GDP, right? It's been growing, but it's not, it's slow. 1%, 0.5%, it's not booming. And yet we were creating jobs, right? It was the longest, biggest sustained job growth in modern history. We got up to something like 16 million jobs. That doesn't square with classic economic theory. If our GDP was sort of growing really anemically, why were we adding jobs and adding jobs and adding jobs in our economy? So the Fed, that led the Fed to say, this is dynamic, okay? I would argue that some of that growth in jobs, despite an anemic GDP, is from imports. Because when we import products like this, we are subsidizing, we're paying for a lot of US content. So remember the solar panels, all the US content that goes into solar panels. Think about all the US content and critical components and technology and IP that go into one of these. If you look at solar installations, at the total value of solar installations, despite Chinese solar panels, US companies capture 70% of the value of a solar installation. Because it's the raw materials and the capital equipment, but it's also after people buy it, they need to be installed and permitted and maintained. That's all captured by American companies. And so the notion that imports somehow displace jobs is basically false on the ground. It actually creates jobs. It supports jobs. So I would agree with you, sir, that the imports distort GDP. And that's another reason why I wouldn't trust this number the next time it comes out. I'll always look at national wealth. And you can track those numbers at the Fed and also through Credit Suisse that does its own studies.
I keep hearing about the Chinese trying to use the yuan to displace the U.S. dollar as the essentially the basis of trade for most countries.
Right.
And they always raise this ugly thing that is, of course, to scare everybody. What do you say about that?
I say that with so many dilemmas for China's economy, they're damned if they do and damned if they don't. China wants to be included as a major currency, and in fact has been included in the basket of currencies that are kept in reserve. But as China moves towards these policies, it must act against its own interests by liberalizing markets like its currency. So right now, the yuan is strictly controlled. And the world powers have told China that you will never be welcome into the club of major currencies unless and until you liberalize your currency account. How can you not have freely traded currency and be a world currency? So that needs to happen first, and that ain't going to happen for a long time, if ever. Because the laws of gravity, as we've seen, are impacting China's economy. Warren Buffett used to say that, you know, when the tide rolls out, you could see who's been swimming naked, right? So China's economy's been slowing for a long time. And you see it in capital flight of $1 trillion. There's a giant hiss going out of China's economy. Manufacturing is leaving and going to other places. So if anything, China is using its vast reserves to try to shore up its currency. And it will continue to try to manage its currency. And so I don't see China enacting these policies which would cut to the bone. Liberalizing currency would be very difficult for China in its current economic circumstances. They didn't do it when times were easy. Now times are hard. So that's one consideration. And two, the depth of the United States market at over $90 trillion, the sheer depth and liquidity of our assets and depth and liquidity of our bonds, you know, dwarfs. I mean, if we're looking at just wealth on the balance sheet, think about it, $60 trillion more wealth in this country in households, businesses, and government, okay? So at the end of the day, that needs to be considered as well. China's nowhere close in becoming a hegemon in global currencies, you know, much less, you know, barely on the basket of currencies. Because, you know, to the extent that it tries to control its own economic, it wants to be a closed economy. No one knows how broad the money supply is in China. No one knows. We think it's 75% bigger than ours, but we're not sure. It's much bigger, probably. So China will continue to clamp down on this stuff, and that will also hamper its ability to become a global player in currency.
We have a company that we have a partner in China and have been working with them for about 18 years. And we import aircraft parts. So my partner in China is an Air AS9100 certified company.
Yeah.
And we make quality parts that are fully qualified, and they go into Boeing and Airbus and so on. So, and that's in southern China. Mm-hmm. And the second point is that we also recently started a business importing LED lighting products. And in Shenzhen, there are at least, there's probably 1,000 reasonably good LED lighting products manufacturing companies. We have visited about 100 of them. Most of them are 10 years old or less. And so there's just a huge, creative, innovative set of manufacturing companies and the educational mm-hmm. system that trains the engineers mm-hmm. in China that's making, there are no equivalents in America. This is not import-export. This is made in China. So my question is, would yeah. you just comment on that innovative, creative part
yes.
of China and
yes,
how
I
good
can.
They can be?
So I will say very quickly that I was 15 years making things in China as well, from auto parts that sold into GM and Volvo, to medical dental supplies that sold into Henry Schein, to food service supplies that sold into Libby and nearby Toledo, to oil rigs that sold into Shell, to tank farm refineries that sold into ConocoPhillips. So I too have seen the length and breadth of the Chinese value chain and agree with you that you can find terrific, typically smaller companies in China that can make many things well. Oftentimes companies will get in trouble with the length and complexity of a supply chain, or often a lead that might seem to be China about to dominating in a certain industry, such as pens, might be slightly elusive. You know, we found out that there was a major push by the government, hundreds of millions of dollars, to fix China's inability to make the point of a pen, which China's had to import all the way until this year. And it took spending hundreds of millions of dollars to try to figure out a pen that could write well. So yes, China can make many things, but China also struggles, such that GE, which brought its light bulb business to China, was finding that the R&D section of their business was not working in a seamless enough fashion with their manufacturing, such that they brought their light bulb business back. So yes, China does have amazing companies that can make great things, but it's also in a risky environment, and the United States also can make great things too. I'll leave that there. We can talk later about that.
I get somewhat kind of related to that. You know, one of the things that I've seen has been kind of interesting is China's efforts to move into more creative fields, and you've talked about the vast wealth of the United States, which I think a lot of that really comes from the creativity and IP as well here. What's your take on Chinese efforts to, you know, kind of move into markets like, you know, movie production, you know, movie studios, those things, more creative endeavors, and, you know, what role do you see that taking in as far as a priority from the government, and how successful do you think those efforts are?
Well, we're seeing now. I mean, the Chinese studios are dictating Hollywood scripts and the endings and the character development, and yeah, so we have this vast Chinese consumer market. One great projection of American soft power is still Hollywood, which either, you know, is great news or keeps you up at night. But China's mere market alone, right? You know, films now need to consider China's censors. And by the way, I mean, if I were in a media company, that might put me in a bit of a quandary. You know, because there are themes and topics and many things that, so studios are self-censoring already for the China market, which I would say is probably a negative. If you like Spider-Man, or movies like that. We're gonna see more and more kind of creative content and talent moving over there, certainly in the gaming industry. We've already seen a big portion of that going to China too. So I see the next century as the China century in terms of Chinese need and demand. So China will need American food, also American expertise. Some of that goes into creative. Some of our great companies are actually, you know, selling all this stuff as product that we in effect are exporting as a service to China. And I think that'll be a growing industry. You know, our exports to China are one of the areas where we have a surplus in services. So we have a surplus in services and in ag. So part of that is creative, and I think that'll continue to grow. You know, the question of IP and IP enforcement becomes though more and more of an issue in that. So certain companies are able to kind of gerrymander their own way and fixing it, and others, you know, get really exposed. So company by company will have to figure out how to protect IP, you know, as they're expanding their creative services in China. Okay? All right. Thank you.